And what really happened in the New Mexico desert almost precisely 58 years ago? Nick Redfern believes he has the answer, and he's written about it in his brand new book, Body Snatchers in the Desert. We'll get Stanton Friedman's view on that particular level of the case as we come back. Also, we're going to have some of your fast blast questions for Stanton Friedman. It's all on the way next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Chris McGill, sitting in tonight for George Norrie. If you're just tuning in, our guest this evening is nuclear physicist and UFO investigator Stanton Friedman. Stanton, welcome back to the program. I have an email message here from Gary in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Now, he's interested in hearing your view of what you believe these extraterrestrials are traveling in, which is the UFOs. What do you think is their method of propulsion in order to get from one location to another across the vast universe?
Well, I'm only interested in the local neighborhood, so I'm not interested in the vast universe particularly.
It all goes back to how do they get here?
Okay, now we got to separate this problem into two parts. One is, how do you fly around in the atmosphere, which is after all where we see them? Going super fast doesn't do you much good if you got to meet somebody for lunch. It only takes a seventh of a second to go around the planet at the speed of light, but if you're going between stars, then it does indeed matter how fast you go. So we have the little Earth excursion modules, and we have the large motherships. And people, in other words, when I say the hills, for example, were picked up by aliens, Betty and Barney Hill, mm-hmm. or what crashed at Roswell was an alien spacecraft, I'm talking about an Earth excursion module, a module operating in the atmosphere with the temperatures and pressures and gravitational field near the Earth. That's very different for between the stars, from between the stars. And just as we have large aircraft carriers, I think aliens have these, I call them motherships simply because people have often reported little ones coming in and out of the big ones. Very similar to the notion of an aircraft carrier. So we have two separate technological problems. When I was in industry, for example, I worked on nuclear fusion propulsion systems for deep space travel. That's not within the atmosphere, where if you're smart and use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end, having 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. I mean, you want improvement. That's the way to go.
Yeah.
Now, that fusion is something we know a lot about. The star, our sun, and all the other stars around, that's where the energy comes from, nuclear fusion. So it's not an H-bombs, too. We don't really want to talk about those, but they're nuclear fusion systems. And between the stars, that would do. Although I must preface that by saying Friedman's law, unfortunately you won't find it in the law books or the scientific books, but technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. So the notion that we can tell what an advanced civilization is able to do based on our technology is pretty silly. We've had advanced technology for, 100 years, first flight roughly 100 years ago, and certainly fancy computers much less than 100 years ago, and first rockets of any size.
And NASA has even done their own propulsion testing, correct?
What?
NASA has even done their own propulsion testing here.
Well, yeah, but the kicker here is that fusion is one technique, and there are people like Michio Kaku who are looking at warping space and time and string theory and all kinds of far-out advanced stuff. We don't know what somebody, let's say, 1,000 years ahead of us. Just look back 50 years. I was using slide rules in industry when I started in the 50s, and I was in a college class recently where none of the students knew what a slide rule was. That's less than 50 years ago.
Come a long way.
Yeah, and so I would suggest nuclear fusion because it's something we know exists. The stars are there, proof of that, and so forth. Now, within the atmosphere, I think something like magneto-aerodynamics is a good candidate. I did a literature search, oh my goodness, more than 30 years ago, for technical reports done under government contracts, as opposed to the open scientific literature that you find in the library. And I got over 900 documents listed under the title Magneto-Aerodynamics. 90% of them were classified. This is where you ionize the air around the craft and you interact with electric and magnetic fields because ionized air is an electrical conductor. The analogy I like to use is seawater, which is 2% salt solution, if you will, and which is an electrically conducting fluid. And an electromagnetic submarine was right. built and tested back in the 60s. I've referenced this in my congressional testimony way back in 68. Makes me feel like an old man to go back this far. But
so do you think they're here within our general area then, so to speak? So they're not really, you know, traversing massive amounts of space and time.
I look upon the local neighborhood within 54 light years of here, which is nothing. I mean, the galaxy is 80,000 light years across. Next big galaxy away is a million light years away. And the universe is 14 billion light years across. So I'm talking down the street, around the corner. Yes.
The local neighbors, so to speak.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it turns out that when you have this ionized air, that's what you see when a meteor comes in, you know. You're not seeing a small hunk of rock. You're seeing the air that's ionized because it's going so darn fast. It separates the electrons from the atoms of the air and so forth. That gets you around all the problems of high-speed flight. You can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, other little tricky things about flying saucers from a physics viewpoint.
Okay,
so, I think we're having visitors from our local neighborhood. Of those within 54 light years, to give you a sense of perspective here, there's about 1,000 stars. Of those 1,000 stars, 46 are similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets and life. That's our local neighborhood. And my favorite pair of such stars is, of course, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the constellation of Reticulum, the net, that means. You can't see them from here. You got to go down the equator. This came out of the Betty and Barney Hill case, anyway. And those two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart. We're out in the boondocks. Next star over, 4.3 or so light years. Next star that's like the sun, 11 light years. But Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli are only an eighth of a light year apart. And
astronomers are finding more and more planets.
They're a billion years older than the sun.
Revolving other stars.
So you'd expect them to have some technology we don't have, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Now, Stanton, last week, author Nick Redfern talked with George here about his new book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story. Now, through information reportedly gathered from military whistleblowers and others, Nick has come to the conclusion that it was an experimental American military craft that actually crashed in the desert, not a UFO. He goes further to state that the pilots were Japanese POWs who were possibly even the victims of diabolical human experimentation. You don't buy the story. Why?
Well, I have read the book, unlike so many of the other people who have been yakking about it. It certainly set up a firestorm of discussion. There are several reasons. Let me preface this by saying I know Nick. I respect the work he's done. We've been at archives together. He's a hardworking guy who has done an awful lot of good research. He's got a book about the FBI and UFOs and several other books. Now, remember that this experimentation was supposedly related to the NEPA project. That's N-E-P-A, Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft. Right after World War II, there was a project at Oak Ridge National Laboratory involving Fairchild Aircraft. It was the NEPA project, and they were looking, doing studies. I mean, you didn't have to be a genius to recognize that the fact that you can get an awful lot of energy in a very small place might be useful for boats, for airplanes, for rockets, for all kinds of systems. And so people were looking at this. Now, the funny part of the story is that I worked on the General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Program from 1956 to 1959, and my area of specialization was radiation shielding. And Nick's hypothesis is that what we have is a Horton flying wing crewed by these deformed or disabled Japanese, and this was carried aloft by a big balloon, and some accident happened and it crashed at Roswell. And the kicker was that because the Nuremberg trials were going on, we were very super sensitive to the fact that people were being accused and convicted of doing diabolical experiments without informed consent. That's a neat way of saying some of the terrible things that were done. And we've heard a lot about the German stuff, but not nearly as much about what the Japanese were doing, this Project 731, I guess it is. The kicker is, though, Nick somehow links this with radiation shielding, and it's not how you do shielding experiments. And it isn't, I know I spent a lot of government money. He was about this kind of stuff. As a matter of fact, there's an article quoted that the program kind of ebbed in 1907 and was canceled in 1961. And as a matter of fact, the program picked up. Our funding in 1958 was $100 million for that year, far more than was spent on all the years of the NEPA project. Radiation shielding, the concern was not contamination, which is what he talks about, but you get a crew on board a nuclear-powered airplane. We did operate jet engines on nuclear power back in the late 50s. Successful application of nuclear energy. It was on the ground, unfortunately. It wasn't flying then. And you want to know how long the crew can operate the plane. So what's your standard for how high the radiation levels can be? And the two important parts to radiation from a nuclear airplane, neutrons and gamma rays. And to shield them, you need high-density materials for the gamma rays, which are like X-rays, only more energetic, and low-density materials with them, like water or paraffin. The Navy has used that on occasion to slow down the neutrons. And so we did an awful lot of experiments at a bunch of different facilities, and none of this relates at all to what Nick is talking about. Furthermore,
would it have left such a debris field as what has been reported that was actually left there?
Well, if it did come down? It's not only that. Remember that Major Marcel, one of his comments to me in our first conversation back in 1978, was that there wasn't anything conventional out there. You know, he was looking for rivets, for wires, for vacuum tubes. Now, the Horton Brothers flying wing technology, and there is one at the Smithsonian, and it's made out of wood, certainly wasn't of extraordinarily strong, lightweight metals. There's no connection between what was seen, the debris field, as you say, lots of it, but all of it peculiar stuff. Major Marcel didn't see any bodies either. And so there may have been an event such as the flight of a strange craft, with disabled Japanese. I'm not saying the government hasn't done all kinds of terrible things. The justification, of course, is national security, and there were experiments done with injecting plutonium into people. Now, most of those people lived a very long time, incidentally, but there really wasn't totally informed consent, just as the experiments done in the South with syphilis, when people were not given the drugs that were available, instead were just infected. That's not nice stuff to talk about, but it's true. So I'm not disagreeing with Nick that there may not have been, there may have been all kinds of strange stuff going on, but I can't find a connection. For example, he talks about the description given by Frank Kaufman of a strange-shaped sort of vehicle, which might be this 9-foot hunk of metal that he talks about. But he doesn't seem to be aware that Kaufman's testimony has been totally thrown out, even by Dr. Kevin Randall, who was his staunchest defender when they found full evidence of fraud on Frank's part.
So overall, you think,
in the presence of three other people, including Linda Howe, incidentally, that he had told the lie about his story of what had happened at Roswell.
So overall, you don't think this story about it being a military aircraft with POWs on board actually happened? Now,
if it did happen, I can't find a connection between that and the witness testimony, either at the Braswell Ranch, the Foster Ranch. Ranch, operated by Mac Brazel, or in the plains of San Agustin. Their testimony indicates an entirely different kind of system, beings, etc. So there may have been these terrible experiments done. I can't, you know, say yay or nay.
Now, what's the best evidence, Stanton, that would prove that this...
My review is on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com. Right. That's FRIEDMAN.com.
Okay.
And I go into detail on it there, and the website UFO Updates that I watch pretty closely and contribute to is that an enormous amount of discussion, but almost all of it was from people who hadn't read the book.
Yeah.
I read the book. I mean, I sent an advance copy. I wrote a review.
So what do you think is the best evidence that would prove this new theory wrong, then, in your mind, in your opinion?
Yes, I would say that the facts prove that the new theory is wrong. Roswell has withstood another assault.
Now, switching gears just a little bit, with all the recent discoveries of all these planets that astronomers are discovering orbiting around other stars, how does that affect your views in general on UFOs?
Well, it certainly takes away the notion that this is the only place where there could be life. And it wasn't too many years ago, let's say 50, that it was thought that planets were produced by a near miss of two stars. And since they're so far apart, this would be a very rare event indeed. Now we no longer think that's how planets are produced, created, whatever, amassed. And so it does take away from the notion that we are unique, special, you know, alone here. Otherwise, it makes it even more likely, you know, the civilizations are either out there or they're not. They're either coming here or they're not. What we know doesn't affect the way reality is. We talk about it's more likely that there's life out there. Now, our perception is we are willing to look further because now we know that, gee whiz, every direction you look, there seem to be planets. Now, remember that our sampling is very much biased by the fact that our techniques aren't good enough to pick out small planets like Earth. Small, dense planets like Earth, I should say. We can pick up the big guys, the Jupiter size, the Saturn size. And we're getting better, but there will be new satellites up within the next 5 years, planet-seeking satellites, that will revolutionize our thinking because they'll be able to get a much truer picture of what's going on in our neighborhood than we can now possibly get. In other words, you pick up three big planets around a star, still doesn't tell you whether there are any little ones or not.
Right. Now, how do you think SETI could use something like this, Stan? Because I know you're still not a very big fan of SETI, correct?
You got it. Silly effort to investigate is not high on my list of scientific endeavors. You want to find out about extraterrestrial life, study the UFO data. The basic assumption that we're in a position to pick up signals from some civilization using techniques similar to ours makes no sense to me. We're not the crown of creation. We're not a very advanced civilization. You know, if you thought that the universe was created in 4004 BC, Bishop Usher back a few hundred years ago, then you can say, gee, we know a lot about the history of the universe, but it was created maybe 12, 14 billion years ago, and we're not at the top of the heap. So SETI, which purports to be concerned with extraterrestrial intelligence, has excluded the whole notion of UFOs from its consideration. Now, you can understand that. If aliens are coming here, who needs to listen for signals? Maybe you should learn sign language. You know, they don't want to do anything that distorts, adds doubt to the notion of whether what they're doing is right. Remember, we got thousands of physical trace cases, loads of abduction cases, multiple witness radar visual cases. What do the SETI people have? Zero. No evidence whatsoever. There's somebody out there sending signals using the kind of equipment whose signals we could interpret.
And the mystery will just have to continue for a little bit longer. We're going to have more to come with my guest, Stanton Friedman. We'll find out if there's anything new in connection with West Virginia's Flatwood Monster case. And next hour, open lines. This is Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, nuclear physicist and UFO investigator Stanton Friedman. On the way, Stanton will give us the latest news on the Flatwoods Monster case in West Virginia. We'll also talk a little bit about some lesser-known UFO crashes around the world. It's all on the way next. Stay right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Chris McGill, filling in tonight for George Norrie. Our special guest, nuclear physicist and UFO investigator, Stanton Friedman, is with us tonight. And Stanton, has anything really new surfaced recently in connection with the Flatwoods Monster case in West Virginia?
Well, you know, Frank Fascino Jr., who is the author of the book, The Braxton County Monster, Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed, which came out last year, may not be easy for some people to get. You can go to wvwestvirginiagreenmonster.com. But the book tells the exciting story of Frank's research on what happened on September 12th, 1952. And there have been witnesses who came forth who saw some things that night because of seeing publicity about the book. But the biggest development has been that Frank in the book talks a lot about Air Force, I'll call it dogfights between UFOs and Air Force jet fighters. And some people protested loudly and strongly there were no such things. So we got a little upset, both of us. And we started looking through the old literature, and we found loads of cases of dogfights between airplanes and government, United States government jet fighters, if you will, and sometimes not jets, but old conventional propeller-driven planes, and UFOs, especially in 1952. And it came as a surprise to me. I mean, everybody's aware that the summer of 52 was a huge time for UFO sightings, especially over Washington, D.C., multiple witness radar sightings and jets chasing UFOs and so forth. But what I didn't know, frankly, as we started to look, and I had help from a number of people who have good collections of clippings and stuff, we found, amazingly, that pilots were ordered to shoot down UFOs.
You're kidding.
Official statements to that effect. And furthermore, that funny name to use, General Roger Ramey, who was involved with Roswell, the famous Ramey memo picture taken in General Ramey's office in Fort Worth, Texas. He was head of the 8th Air Force at the time in 47. Well, by 1952, he was part of the Air Defense Command. And we found a couple articles in which it was noted that General Ramey said, "We have scrambled jets hundreds of times." Now, the kicker here is that can you picture, I mean, a cartoonist would have a field day with this. Pilots ordered to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so.
Now, what's the thinking behind that? Because if these UFOs can obviously come from other worlds, they most certainly must have higher forms of technology as far as weaponry.
Yeah, and the thing that Ramey was saying was we don't seem to be able to catch up to them. So, you know, can't you see the pilot pointing at the UFO and putting thumbs down? You know, you guys go down there and the alien laughing. But part of the underlying concern here, incidentally, was that I had mentioned, and I wrote the foreword and the epilogue to the book, and I had mentioned that I had received on six different occasions stories about more planes going up, more of our jet fighters going up after a UFO than came back down. Two go up, one comes down, three go up, two come back. If I've heard of six instances, there have probably been many other instances. And what we started finding was you can't believe the number of airplanes that disappeared or disintegrated. There were three.
So are they shooting back at us then?
Yeah, I think so. Well, shooting may be the wrong word here. But
well, right, yeah.
Zapping, whatever you want to call it. But
whatever they have.
Yeah, we had three pilots who had over 100 missions each in Korea who came back to the U.S., part of the Air Defense Command. And we were very concerned, incidentally, in 52, The young people may not be aware of that, but we honestly expected the Russians to be attacking because it was clear that Joe Stalin now had a number of nuclear weapons and he had big airplanes for delivering them. And so we were very concerned about the continental defense of the United States, and we're very sensitive about this. And, I won't say trigger happy, but worried about this. And here we find all these indications that maybe some of these losses, can it really be that the planes were so poor or the pilots so poor? I mean, how does a guy survive 100 missions fighting MiGs, which weren't bad airplanes, incidentally, and comes back to the U.S. without any MiGs, and somehow his plane crashes and he's gone.
And now, so, was there a crash involved in the Flatwoods incident there?
There was a crash at Flatwoods. I'll call it a controlled landing. How's that? Does that sound better than a crash?
That's better than a crash.
Yeah, because it took off again. That's the point. Most crashed airplanes don't take off again. That one did. It landed at the only flat place in the area. It was seen by a bunch of kids. They went up after it. Some kind of a mechanical device comes from behind a tree, scares the heck out of them. They get sick from some kind of a gas emitted by this device. The Army gets called in the reserve, and Frank is the only guy who's been able to interview the guy who was head of that reserve group. They came in secret. They picked up specimens of stuff. Never heard anything back from where they sent the specimens. It's a fascinating story. And the witnesses, I was lucky enough when I went there for the 50th anniversary, that's how I got involved in this thing, which was 2002, to meet the primary witness, Mrs. May, still alive, her two sons who were still alive. Saw the tree from behind which the monster, so-called, came. Got a lot of publicity at the time, incidentally. But Frank got people to open up. He spent 10 years on this case. Can you imagine? And the Air Force official explanation, it was all meteors that followed rivers, that made right-angle turns, that covered huge swatches of land seen over a couple hours. Most incredible meteors you ever heard of. But when you look at the descriptions given by witness, there weren't no meteors. And so because of the book and the reaction to the reports of all these encounters, we've come up, I suspect, we got an accident report. People should know, incidentally, that military aircraft accident reports are very hard to get. They want pilots and others involved to be very upfront about their comments. So they classify these things, and even families of plane crashed, cause unknown, who want to sue the government because somebody goofed, couldn't get access to the reports. Well, now after more than 50 years, you can get some of these reports. And Frank talks about one case in which a pilot and a navigator in an F-94C on September 12th, the same day as the Flatwoods event, disappeared out over the Gulf of Mexico. When you read the report, it's a comedy of errors or lies or a combination of the two. And you wonder how many other instances do we have? Because of all the dollar value of all these airplanes that crashed,
has to be astronomical.
Is incredible. And not only happened in the United States, happened in England and Europe too.
Now, Stan, how many aircraft are we talking about here? Do you have any idea how many military, U.S., or whatever country aircraft?
Hundreds have, over a few-year period.
And that's just a few years?
Yeah, just very few years, early 50s. It's astonishing when you look at the list. And as a matter of fact, New York Times was bragging about how we're doing better because the number of accidents per 100,000 hours flown, had dropped some. But the numbers are shocking as to how many airplanes went down. Hundreds and hundreds. Guys killed too, of course, in most of these. And the term disintegration is used on occasion. Now, how the heck does an airplane disintegrate? Flying along and zappo! And one of the six cases that I mentioned earlier that I had heard about was near Cuba, 1967. Two MiGs go up after a UFO that's heading southwest toward Cuba. They talk to the ground. They interrogate the, try to interrogate the UFO, a spherical object with no appendages. What should we do? And the ground says, this is picked up by the National Security Agency, the linguists who listen in on foreign military communications. And the ground says, shoot it down. So the lead pilot arms his missile, gets his radar lock on, and suddenly there's shrieking from the second pilot, the wingman, that the first plane just disintegrated. And this was sent into NSA headquarters, and they were told to list the plane loss as equipment malfunction. I guess if your plane disintegrates, your equipment malfunction.
That is a major malfunction, I would think.
Yeah. And so this is one of the cases, and I talked to the guy who heard this conversation, and the government reacted very strongly when somebody tried to get more information under Freedom of Information. Fortunately, I was the only one who knew the guy, the informant's name, and I wasn't giving it out. But the FBI visited somebody who made requests, the Air Force, the equivalent of Judge Advocate General, whatever they're called for the Air Force, called the young man who made these requests and, you know, put all that stuff away, it's highly classified, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, what happened? And what was going on in 1952, and why were we instructing pilots to shoot down flying saucers? And why does General Ramey admit hundreds of times jets had been scrambled when the Air Force official policy is, gee, these things aren't a threat to the security of the United States?
They're no threat at all, yeah. Now, I recently read the book called Dark Object by Don Ledger and Chris Stiles. Now, this tells the story of the Shag Harbor incident, a story where a UFO reportedly crashed in Shag Harbor, Canada. Did you ever investigate that particular case?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, I mentioned in the book several times.
I noticed that they had called you in the process of putting this book together.
Yeah, and I gave them some suggestions on where to get information in Ottawa, Canada's capital, which is not Toronto. Some people seem to think it is. It's Ottawa, and the National Archives of Canada are there. And yeah, and I did check out, I've talked to some witnesses. This is different from Roswell in the sense that not only was it 20 years later, but there were actual witnesses to the object going down into the water off Shag Harbor. And RCMP got involved, and the official paperwork says it was an unidentified flying object. Now, you know, what they, the guys talked to Navy divers who went down and were looking for stuff. So I think it's a very good case. And, you know, there are some national security concerns here in terms of, that's at the southwest corner, if you will, of Nova Scotia.
Right.
And Russian submarines that want to get near the United States, might go by there. And so there was some concern about the United States got involved in this search, no question about that.
Well, there was
that.
A major United States submarine base there close by, right?
Well, yeah, there's submarines and there are listening posts underwater devices for monitoring the passage of Soviet submarines and other craft. So you can understand a little stickiness on the part of the government on what they're going to say, you know, who's doing what, where, when, and how.
But exactly.
Excellent case. The witnesses, many of them were young, still alive. We're losing the Roswell guys pretty darn fast, as you know. I mean, 58 years ago, that's kind of a long time. So, yeah, I like the story. I'd consider it one of Canada's top 10 UFO cases, no question about that. And the guys did a nice job, and they're still active. Don Ledger's on UFO updates. He's a pilot, incidentally. And has written a lot of stuff, not only about UFO sightings in the maritime provinces of Canada. I live in one, New Brunswick, even though I have a post office box in Maine. And this confuses people, and I'm sorry.
It's not very far away, though.
No, it was 73 miles to beautiful downtown Holton, Maine. Post office box 958, Holton, Maine, 04730-0958. And you can get a free list of books. Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. You go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and you can order books and videos and even, hey, I'm going modern. We got a DVD out.
I hear that. You're going DVD now, so you're heading into the 21st century.
Yeah, two volumes. Well, it took me a while to get out of the 19th century. But, Yeah, that case is a good one. And I recommend the book if you can find it. It's not so easy to find in the bookstores, but probably through Amazon. You know, they got everything.
Yeah. And I want to remind the listeners, too, that, Stanton, you'll be the special guest on Streamlink's live chat at 8 p.m. Pacific time later today, too. So a lot of folks can get a chance to speak with you there on the live chat. Now, we did have a fast blast come in. A person would like to hear about your story of the Foo Fighters of World War II. Can you talk about that briefly before we go to the next break?
Just briefly, just say that there were pilots on both sides, the Allies and the Germans and also the Japanese, about these strange lights, things that would circle around bombers. I talked to a French pilot. They expected to be shot down imminently. This is during World War II. And so each side had these things. They each thought they were secret weapons of the other side, and it was only after the war, when pilots got together, as they will, that, you mean that's not yours? No, we thought it was yours. And the question is, what the heck were these things? And Foo Fighters, I've seen three different stories about what the origin of the term, but for those of you who read the comic books back 50 years ago, Smokey Stover, I guess that was his name, and talked about Foo, where there's smoke, there's fire. The French word F-E-U is fire, mispronounced, of course, but what the heck. And so after the war, there was a trying to figure out, and during the war, the worry was there somebody else's secret weapon, and we got to watch out for this. But there were no cases where these things seemed to do any damage to any of the airplanes on either side. So are these devices sent out by aliens attracted to Earth by all the horrible things going on this planet? You know, we talk about nuclear weapons toward the end of the war, but there was Hamburg and Dresden and the firebombing of Tokyo. We destroyed square miles of Tokyo with firebombing. The houses go up pretty quick when they're made out of, you know, paper and wood and stuff like that. So anybody in the neighborhood who wanted to check out planet Earth would say, holy cow, look what these guys are doing. What's going on here? The concern, I would suspect, from any advanced civilization in the neighborhood as opposed to our primitive society would be, how soon will this new technology get these guys to come out so they can bother us? That would be a legitimate concern, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, given our record of activity during World War II. You know, young people are shocked when I use these terms, but we killed at least 50 million of our own kind, Earthlings, during World War II. 50 million. Some say 70 million, but I'm a very conservative guy, as you know, Chris. Only 50 million.
That's still bad.
Yeah, 1,700 cities. This is not a good indication of guys that you want to join you out in your neighborhood, is it? I wouldn't think so.
So do you think maybe the visitations are coming then to try to help us, to try to get us out of this whirlwind and this downward spiral we seem to be going in?
Well, I'd look at it the other way. I think they're here to quarantine us.
Well, that's another possibility, too. Because a lot of people believe that, yes, they're not here to be our friends.
Yeah, well, maybe if we recognize that there is a more advanced civilization, this would help us understand that you can get through this stage of too much technology and not enough sociology. We're good at killing. We're really good at that. But that's not a good thing for the future, is it? Because if we kill ourselves, how much future will we have? So, you know, I've got a paper with 26 different reasons for coming to planet Earth. One of them is their broadcasters, the weekly radio show, Idiocy in the Boondocks.
That's true. Well, before we go to the break here, I want to remind everyone that we'll have an opportunity for you to ask your questions with nuclear physicist and UFO investigator Stanton Friedman coming up after the top of the hour. The numbers for you west of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, toll free, 1-800-825-5033. The first time caller line, 1-818-501-4721. And the wild card line, 1-818-501-4109. We're back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.